manufactured by Directive Systems, good old Dave Olean, K1WHS in Lebanon, Maine, is the president of a company called Directive Systems. He will build for you a Yagi on 3 gigahertz, which has 102 elements to it. And the first thing somebody will say was, yeah, the first 30 elements are doing all the work and the rest of them are just sitting there. Uh-uh. You measure that antenna, all those elements are hot. They're all doing something. In the case of a very, very long Yagi like that, a slightly different phenomenon takes place. That's the so-called slow wave structure. It's a synthesized dielectric. It's acting like a skeleton version of a double convex magnifying glass, gathering signal from a great big chunk of space out there and focusing it all on the driven element. So long Yagis are a little bit different, but on most of our HF Yagis, they're primarily co-phase and anti-phase interferometer type antennas, just like you guys would possibly appreciate my impression of how a Yagi works. I think we ought to pick up Rich before we put him to sleep. KC2LTY, go ahead with your question, Rich. K2RIW on the TechNet.
And then come back to me, Tech, for a comment.
Sure will. You got it first, Rich.
Good evening. The time is 9:03.
Okay, it's actually two questions. One is about an antenna, which I do glad to ask when my turn would come up. The other one is I jumped in at the in the middle here. I thought you were talking about old radios, and I have something here looking for a good home. An old Globe Electronics Model 303 radio. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I haven't, but I bet your Mel has, and Mel and a few other people. Mel and Rich both keep track of the older radios and the oldies but goodies. First of all, looks like Rich is making an offer, and is Rich Rommel interested in KC2LTY's offer? Speak now.
Well, if he's got a, did he say a Nationals NC303, is that what you have, over?
Go ahead, Rich.
Stand by 1 second, please.
He thought he said it was a Globe came through.
I think he said Globe. We'll soon find out exact brand name and model number.
Okay, well, because I'm familiar with the Nationals, made it the NC303 years ago. It was quite a nice receiver, big receiver, but nice piece of equipment for its day. I was just going to mention another interesting effect that, you know, you hear on 80 meters is the effects of the aurora borealis, the northern lights. Dick, I've experienced that quite a number of times. That's quite an interesting effect you get, over.
Oh boy, is it. I have heard aurora reflections on 432 megacycles when I was running that great big array of 16 Yagis, 304 elements. Barry and I were both running some pretty big arrays of Yagis at that time, and it was very interesting to see the hot spots in the aurora. In other words, as you would wave this antenna back and forth that had a 5.5-degree beam width, you would see lots of reflection of the aurora over, let's say, a 20-degree width of the antenna. In other words, you could wave the antenna back and forth 20 degrees and get a reflection. But somewhere in that 20 degrees was a hot spot where you would hear a very strong reflection. And 20 minutes later, the hot spot would drift to some other direction. Very interesting, very dynamic. On top of that, you could tell that the cloud of aurora electrons was rotating in a counterclockwise manner, top view. The reason I say that is because as I would aim my antenna away from the hot spot toward the west, I would hear a positive Doppler shift. As I aim my antenna away from the hot spot toward the east, I would hear a negative Doppler shift. So, in other words, the guy is sending you Morse code, and the pitch of the Morse code you're hearing would go up and down, not because I'm retuning the receiver, simply because I'm moving the antenna. Very exciting phenomenon. I've also seen that on 10 gigs when you aim a 3.5-degree beam width dish antenna, 3 feet in diameter. You would aim it at a rain cloud. To the left of the rain cloud, you would hear a positive Doppler shift. To the right of the rain cloud, you hear a negative Doppler shift because, again, the rain cloud is the middle of a low-pressure center, and the air is rotating counterclockwise around that low. so passively just by sitting there listening, both on 432 with Aurora and on 10 gigs with rain clouds, I was doing a kind of a passive radar experiment in which I could find out something about where was the cloud, how was it moving, where is it going next, and so on, just by sitting there listening and waving my antenna back and forth and interpreting the results. Let's see if Rich has found the model number of it. I think it's a Globe 303 that you said you've got, Rich. KC2LTY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KC2LTY, I'm back.
Go ahead. What model number is that, Rich?
I don't have it here. It's in my basement, but I think it's manufactured by Globe Electronics, and I believe it's model M303. And I'm 99% sure it's just a transmitter. It's, I would guess, around 1960. It's weighs about 40 pounds, about 6 inches tall, 12 inches wide, and 12 inches deep. But it's in almost mint condition.
Okay, Mel, are you familiar with that one?
Think so. Does it have a meter right in the center of the panel, Rich? Over.
I believe so. On the right side, you can plug in the old style large crystals.
Yeah, I know the radio. Yeah, I think so. That's that's why I asked if it had the meter right in the center, and it has the two tuning knobs either side, a crystal holder right up on top next to the meter, well, to the right of the meter. Yeah, I remember that radio. Well, what you could do, you put that out on eBay, and I'll guarantee you you're going to sell that, Rich, over.
And he'll get some money for it, Cape Turo.
Yeah, that's an oldie but goodie, Rich.
Well, first thing is I don't have a computer, and I wouldn't know what to ask for it. You know, I'm looking for advice here.
All you got to do is find somebody with a computer who has a little bit of familiarity with eBay and one of the people who has already signed in to eBay, and you don't have to set a price. You can set a starting bid value. In other words, you might say, I won't accept anything below $20, for instance, and then let people bid on it. And if it's an oldie and goodie that somebody has fallen in love with and he remembers it as his first rig when he was a novice in 1960, you'd be amazed what some people will pay for things. There are a number of situations where somebody had an old boat anchor in his basement that he was worth, that he thought was worth $30, a signal generator scope or something like that. He put it on eBay and it sells for $691. There's a whole lot of stories like that. So find somebody with a computer who has a little bit of familiarity with eBay and tell them what you got. Give them a minimum bid price that you'll accept. After that, let the feeding frenzy take place, Rich, and there's about an 80% chance you're going to end up happy. And your only big problem after that is how do you box it up in order to ship it, and you got to give the guy very specific instructions about the fact that you want it to be either a postal money order that you know is not going to bounce, and therefore you'll mail it immediately, or if he, you'll give him warning ahead of time that if he sends you a personal check, that until the check clears, you will not be mailing the item, just to make sure you're not getting a piece of rubber. With those couple of caveats, I think you're going to end up happy on this one, Rich. And go ahead with your antenna question. KC2LTY, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay, until Rel, just real quick, comment on the Globe.
Okay. Hold on before you take off, Rich. Both Steve and our man up in Yonkers wants to give you further information. Steve, go ahead first.
Okay, you need to take some pictures of it, though. They really, you know, it helps a lot to sell radio with pictures. And also, PayPal's a good thing. You know, they have a thing called PayPal, where it's kind of like an intermediate thing. And also tell them they have to pay the shipping, because, you know, the radio's not that light. That's just my comments. And I have a question later on.
Okay, we'll put you on the list. Very good suggestions, yeah. What Steve is telling you is very valuable information, particularly when you've got something that you're fairly sure is in mint condition. A good photograph of it makes the sales get twice as high, and the feeding frenzy takes place twice as fast. Mr. JJ, go right ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and all aboard. Just a little info on the HG303. It was manufactured between 1961 and 62. Covered 80 through 10 meters, CW only. 6146 in the final. And basically a novice type transmitter, and sold in those days for $99.95. So there you go.
Okay, thank you, Doug. Very good starting information. So that'll help Rich decide what his minimum bid is, and hopefully he's got a good camera or somebody he can borrow a good camera. And yes, you want to tell him that they're going to pay shipment, and PayPal is a way that you can guarantee that you will get paid if you set up an account with them. In both cases, both with eBay and PayPal, you have to first prove to them that you're a person who's got a reasonable credit rating, and you open up an account with them, and therefore they will act as your intermediary, charge you a very small fee in order to provide their service. So, and it's not too difficult. So find somebody with a computer and have at it, Rich. Go ahead with your antenna question. KC2, LTY, K2LAW. My name is Dick.
About 6 months ago, another ham with a computer saw a few of these on eBay. Not the same model number, but close to it. And they were selling for $5.
Understand. And eBay prices go all over the place. I mean, every so often somebody will take a Britney Spears chewing gum that she threw out on the street, and they'll pick it up and sell it on eBay for $503. I mean, there are cases like that. And there are other cases where a $500 piece of instrumentation with that real value today will sell for $10. It's crazy. So where's your antenna question, Rich?
Okay, antenna question. Where I am here, my property is 25 feet wide and 100 feet long. And from the back of the house, which is about 45 feet from the front of the property, leaving me about 55 feet, leaving me 35 feet. And from the back of my house, there's a concrete building with a steel roof about 30 feet high from the south to the north. And from the east to west, to the west of me, is another building, 25 feet tall, cement block building. And to the south of me, east of me, is a house, another house, and then another building 25 feet tall. I'm kind of like in a little box here. And I made a 6-meter dipole antenna, which I'm having problems with originally getting the SWR adjusted to a low point. I bought an antenna kit to make a dipole antenna, and I cut the wires to the proper length, and I strung it up, and I had a super high SWR. I brought this question up about 2 months ago, and A, was something wrong with it, or B, it was location, and B, it turned out to be location. So I relocated this antenna to a different location, which I don't have too many, between a tree I have in the yard and the house on a rope, but it's not very high up. It's about 25 feet off the ground. What can I do make things better here for me with this dipole antenna?
And once again, it's a 6-meter dipole, and now that you relocated it with 25 feet off the ground in a different location, what standing wave ratio are you getting out of that dipole there, Rich?
About 1.2 to 1 on 50 300, I think. I basically want to use it for a 6-meter sideband. See, it was too close to a steel mast for the 2-meter 440 antenna that I'm using. So I moved it away from that, and I, without making any adjustments to the wires, and the SWR went down dramatically. Now, my problem is to try and get this antenna higher up in the air. Would that improve my transmission and reception, considering all the obstructions surrounding me? Or if it was 20 feet off the ground or 30 feet off the ground, make a difference?
Okay. Before I proceed, let me make sure I understand your antenna. You're making it sound like it is a 6-meter dipole. Is that a little over 9 feet long, the wider of that dipole, in between your outer insulators? Go ahead.
Yeah, end to end. Yeah, it's each wire is approximately 52 inches long from the center out. Yeah, it's about that. It's 103 inches long total, end to end, from an insulator to the other one, other side.
Okay, you've absolutely proven to me you've got a 6-meter dipole, conventional. And a 1.2 VizWire at 50.300 is a very nice VizWire, and that's an extremely good location for the single sideband portion of the band, particularly when the band opens and people start spreading all the way up to 51 megacycles or so, depending on how big the opening is. On 6 meters, those concrete buildings near you probably are partially transparent. They're not completely blockers, unless there are, you know, complete flat sheet of steel with all the panels all welded together, which I doubt very highly. But you are definitely getting some decrease in signal in the direction of those concrete buildings near you, the box that's around you. Altitude will help, but altitude is not going to be night and day. I mean, if you're 30 feet up right now and you manage to get it 75 feet up, the guys that you listen to coming in over long distance over the horizon, those signals are going to get 8 or so or 10 dB stronger, but that's not going to suddenly make a completely closed band open to you. Altitude always helps. Now, in your case, when you got very close buildings, it's kind of hard to estimate. If you had a hill that was nearby, say, for instance, your favorite direction for working DX on 6 meters was to the west. You want to talk to your buddy in Michigan, we'll say, or maybe that's northwest, but you know what I mean. And you had a hill that was a half a mile or a mile away, and you want to know what you're going to gain. The National Bureau of Standards, among other people, have published some nice books on this, and the answer is 6 decibels per degree. And I'll explain that. Whenever you change the sighting location, altitude, or location of an antenna, so that the horizon in the direction you care about dips away one more degree, all signals over that horizon get 6 dB stronger, or is it 12 dB stronger? 12 dB per degree. Sorry about that. 12 dB per degree. A 1 degree is 92 feet per mile. So if you had a hill exactly 1 mile to the west of you, and by some magic you raised your antenna 92 feet, so now that the signal coming over that hill is 1 degree more depressed than it was before, all signals over that hill would be now 12 decibels stronger. So when it comes to real distances, quarter mile, half mile, 10 miles or whatever, to a hill, that formula works, and it works very well. When it comes to real close things, like 50 and 100 feet away, a concrete building, which radio-wise now is a complicated structure. In other words, if you and I had X-ray eyes, Rich, and we looked at that building, you probably see a concrete facade on the outside. Maybe you see either wooden or metal frame on the inside. What's the spacing between the metal frames, the girders, how well they connected together. There's a bunch of variables that are not easy to predict as to how transparent that building is. My gut feel is as you raise your antenna above those buildings, you're going to see an improvement. But now, is the improvement going to be 2 dB, or is the improvement going to be 20 decibels? I don't know. You got a lot of variables involved. For a guy of your resources who really wants a good excuse to put up a tower, and on the assumption that your community will let you do it, I would put up the tower. And whether it be an expanding telescoping guide tower, or whether it be a real Rhone 25, or whether it be a crank of tower, those are your choices, and it's a function of what you find at a good flea market. But for VHF and HF operators, the ones who really enjoy the hobby, in my opinion, are the ones who own a tower. I've owned towers now for 40 years, and I've developed an awful lot of pleasure out of them. And putting various antennas at various altitudes and changing the antennas and changing the tower, yeah, it's a little bit of work, but with the right kind of safety equipment and with the right kind of common sense, it can be a lot of fun on the assumption you can afford it and if your community will let you do it. So I didn't give you an exact answer. I gave you some of the variables involved. Drag your feet a little bit in case other people have other suggestions here, Rich. KC2LTY with a little bit of delay. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay. The affordability on a tower is one issue. Putting one up is no problem. I checked into that. The property is industrial. I can go 75 feet. The other thing is the Long Island Railroad is right next to me. If you would put a tape measure from the third rail to my antenna, it's approximately 75 to 80 feet. Would that have any kind of an effect?
Not at all. If you put up the right kind of a tower that is well grounded, even if the absolute worst happened and your tower fell down like a pencil and laid directly across the third rail, that third rail has got a protection insulator above it. Your chances of penetrating that are very slim. Your chances of that antenna falling 75 feet away and hitting that third rail and going over your fence or over your hedge or whatever, very rare experiment, very rare situation. I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep about that. I would make sure that my structure is strong enough and that when the westerly wind blows because of a great big hurricane, that it's not likely to fall in that direction. I would make sure that I've taken some good precautions to try to keep that from happening. But I wouldn't let that stop you, Rich. Go ahead.
No, I'm not worried about that. My question was, would I get any type of electrical interference from the railroad? Someone told me that being close to the railroad can cause electrical interference and is also a lightning attractor. Now, I've been lightning is notoriously homes in on me. This summer, actually, there was a very close hit to me. I don't know where, but it sounded like it hit my antenna, but I was actually transmitting at that particular time when this hit came. And everyone who was listening thought I was barbecue. But would I get any type of electrical interference from the railroad? I mean, it's DC power, and occasionally I get a lot of static. Sometimes on 2 meters, sometimes on 6 meters, and it comes and goes. Like for instance, one particular evening, I had almost a 50% bar, you know, on the signal strength meter on the radio was noise, static noise on 2 meter FM, and 5 or 6 hours later it dissipated, and you know, three or four months later I get it again one night.
Okay, that third rail of your railroad with its DC power, probably 600 volts, and also your Con Ed wiring or your LIPA wiring in the neighborhood, when you get insulator breakdown, when you get arcing of wiring because a splice is not making good contact, or somebody is running a really faulty piece of equipment, any of those situations can give you interference. If you've got the right kind of a noise blanker in the receiver, one of the really good ones is called a LAMB noise blanker. L-A-M-B is a man's name who invented a certain kind of a noise blanker. With the right kind of a noise blanker, it can take out those spikes. And a good noise blanker can take out 99% of the spikes, and you almost don't even know they're there. So an awful lot of the spiking interference you get from power lines and third rail, with the right kind of equipment, you can make that disappear. So I wouldn't let that worry you. It's going to be an annoyance, but there's correction factors for that. For a 432 operator, in the old days, the thing that used to give us all a tremendous amount of interference was the Montauk Point radar, a Air Force AF, FPS 35 radar. It ran a zillion watts of power, and when it aimed at me, there were times when that signal was 120 decibels above my threshold. I could disconnect the antenna and still hear that radar, and that's 70 miles away from me to Montauk Point. And when I turned on the right kind of a noise blanker, aimed the antenna directly at the radar, and I'm listening to a weak signal off the back lobe, the radar was east of me, I aimed the antenna to the east, and a weak signal to the west of me, I had no trouble listening to it when the noise blanker is on. So there's some real good noise blankers. When it comes to lightning, yes, do make sure you get the right kind of grounding of your equipment to give you partial protection from lightning. I say the word partial protection because nothing is 100% protection. But in my particular case, Rich, I've got 100 feet of tower sitting on top of a chunk of land that's 300 feet above sea level in Huntington. So the top of my antenna is 400 feet above sea level. You would think I would be struck with lightning all the time. And I've been running that tower since 1969. I've had three lightning strikes here, all of them of 110 volt line, not the tower. If you had eyes that could see the wiring of your community, and you took a top view picture of your community, you would see your Con Ed and your LiPo wiring goes all over the place. It's a great big set of monkey bars. It's a huge, great big grid of a target. 98% of the time, lightning will strike that grid. So when it comes to lightning protection, most of the lightning protection you care about is protection of the spike of voltage you get on your 110-volt line. Once in a blue moon, lightning could strike your tower, but you'd be amazed how rare it is. Just because it's a shiny piece of metal that you put there, just because you've got pride that it's high, psychologically, you think that lightning is going to say, aha, that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for Rich's tower, and I want to strike that. And lightning is not quite that smart. It just says, where's the biggest target? And the biggest target is the power wiring in your community, and 98% of the time, that's what it hits. All of the damage that I have suffered was 110-volt damage, not because of lightning striking the tower itself. KC2LTY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, roger that. I hear you there. Well, when this hit came this summer, it didn't hit the electric power lines because there was no interruption, a little blink. But another factor is I'm about 400 feet, maybe 500 feet from the village water tower, which is very high. So, I don't know. Years ago, when I was on CB as when I was a kid, I know I was hit by lightning three times. One radio burned up, and once I had a fire in the basement. So I'm a magnet for it. Anyway, no, what I have right now is definitely grounded. I have 22-foot pieces of 2-inch pipe, and I have a 8-foot copper-clad ground rod, number 4. Wire from there to the rod, so that's I'm grounded on that end. Anyway, you answered my question. I thank you very much. That's KC2LTY. Back to TechNet.
Pretty fine, Rich. One other comment. Just because your power doesn't get interrupted doesn't mean that your power lines were not struck. 90% of the lightning strikes on the power line will give you a 5 or a 10 or a 15,000 volt spike that lasts for about 20 microseconds. It can do all kinds of damage to your equipment. It can short out the transformer windings on the primary of anything that's got a power transformer. It can blow out your refrigerator, your television set, your computer. That's why you've got these spike arrestor devices that you plug your computer into, or you've got an uninterruptible power supply in the computer. So What I'm getting at is when lightning strikes your power line, and maybe it's 5 blocks away from your house, and you get this huge voltage spike on your power line that potentially can do damage of the equipment in your house that's plugged in at that time, that most of the time will not trip the primary power fuse. In other words, the power gives you that spike and just keeps right on cranking. So just the fact that your LiCPR or your Con Ed power didn't get interrupted doesn't mean that the spike didn't strike that line. And that's not the clue. You can't tell. It takes a really big hit to knock out the power. And a much smaller hit can do an awful lot of damage. Okay, I think it was Mel who wanted to make some more comments on all of these crazy subjects we talked about in the past. K2KEY and company, K2IW and the TechNet.
Yeah, real quick, Dick. It's like the telephone pole that was hit by a car three or four, maybe 5 blocks from your house, and it severed the ground wire that comes down from the top of the pole, and the pole wasn't broken, but that wire was never repaired, and that can cause havoc when you get a hit.
It sure can. On top of that, when that ground wire on the pole does not get replaced, there's a great big chunk of copper on the bottom of the telephone pole, which they call the butt plate. And it's supposed to be a piece of 8-gauge or 6-gauge wire running from there up to the grounding lead of the pole pig transformer in order to complete the primary circuit. Your primary circuit on most of our wiring in the residential communities is 7,800 volts or 13.2 kilovolts, some number like that, is the voltage going into the primary. And the ground lead completes that circuit, and if that ground wire running down the pole is not replaced, the grounding for the primary of the transformer is picked up by the grounding that goes to your house, and it goes to your water pipe, and you're completing the primary circuit, that 7,800 volt circuit, for the distribution wiring of in your community. Therefore, if a plumber comes to your house, and if he's about to replace your main water valve that comes into the house, if he's got half a brain, when he first unsolders that pipe, he makes sure he's got a huge clamp, very similar to a jumper cable you use on starting an automobile, that kind of an electrical jumper cable. He should connect it to both sides of the copper pipe before he separates those pipes in order to replace that main input valve. If he doesn't do that, there's a zillion electrical contractors who didn't know about that. They've got one piece of pipe in the left hand, the other piece of pipe in the right hand, and they unplug the two, and all of a sudden the 7,800 volts appears between their two hands, and most likely they ain't going to survive that. So you get that very dangerous condition. In fact, there's a lot of guys who have a clamp-on ammeter that's got a great big a donut in the hole in the center of it, and if they clamp it around the water pipe in their house as it goes by the main valve, you'd be amazed how many guys are running 5 amperes of current at a 60-cycle frequency running through that water pipe. And if anybody ever breaks that water pipe, all of a sudden that becomes an open circuit with 7,800 volts across it, simply because somebody hasn't replaced that ground wire to the butt plate. There's a lot of communities where that wire doesn't get replaced, and with a little bit of luck, we get away with it. But it's an accident waiting to happen. So with that knowledge, be careful. And if you do have a clamp-on ammeter, make a measurement of the current flowing through your water pipe. And if it's anything more than a few milliamps, start asking questions. Anyone else with any comments on all this before we go on? K2RIW and the TechNet.
Not for nothing, Dick. I am a plumber, and I have disconnected water mains, broke the meter coupling, and the house went off with a big arc more than a dozen times already, and I used jumper cables to reconnect to make the lights come on. I've been through that a dozen times or better, where I disconnect, and the whole house goes out.
Tell me about how you did that disconnect. Where were your two hands located during that disconnect? And how in the world did you survive that, Rich?
Well, I used a pole channel lock, so the Most of the time, you're loosening a nut. It's called a meter coupling. It's a water meter. And always, I never touch the pipes with two hands. Always with one hand. For instance, on the house side, I would grab the pipe to pull it away. And you start to see an arc and the lights flicker, and then they go out completely. And you touch the, you put it back together, and the lights come back on. If you have one hand on the street side and one hand on the house side, and it comes apart, you become the loop and get the barbecue. Now, I never, I'm a little careful on that point, and make sure you're not standing in a puddle.
And even though you're using rubber-covered channel lock fires, the ones with the great big blue rubber covering on the handles, even that is marginal as to whether or not that's going to give you protection from 7,800 volts. Give me a couple more words on that one, Rich.
Also keep in mind that the pair of channel locks I'm using is 10 years old with 15% of the insulation missing. So I'm in almost contact with the steel. And I've touched the pipe with one hand. I've been zapped already quite a few times. I know what it feels like. I once got hit with 330. If you're not grounded, you can touch anything. If you're grounded, you're looking for trouble. Never use two hands. Then it's going to go. Electricity is going to travel through your body and pop your heart. If you're going to touch something where there's a possibility of electrical shock, use one hand. And look on the floor where before you touch it. If you're standing in a puddle of water or on a piece of wood, wet concrete could be a problem. I already was in a situation where I unsoldered a half-inch pipe to replace a valve in a house. That was this line was going to a kitchen sink, and I'm standing on a wet concrete floor, and pulled the pipe apart and got zapped, and the lights in the basement got dimmer when it was apart, and when I reattached it, they got a little bit brighter. Another puzzle. Plenty of bizarre situations with electricity and plumbing. It's very dangerous, I can tell you that, but I've seen quite a bit in my time in 25 years.
Fantastic. Rich, I would recommend you go out and buy a very thick pair of rubber gloves that you wear when you're using that nicked up blue insulation on your channel lock pliers. How expensive would a good thick pair of rubber gloves for that operation be? Go ahead.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I can't work with gloves. I mean, I personally, I use two fingers to check to see if a circuit is live, because I do boiler installations and wiring and work a lot with electricity. So my grandfather was an electrician, and when I was a kid, I watched him, and he actually would lick his fingers before he touched the wires to see if they were hot. That's what he used for a meter.
Yep, I've seen people do that. You wouldn't have to wear the rubber gloves all the time, but when you're separating a pipe in a suspicious situation like that, where that pipe is providing the grounding for the local power system, I do recommend you wear a thick pair of well-insulated gloves. Amazing. I bet you've heard stories like that of the wiring in Brooklyn. Is that true, Mel? K2KEY, KTYW in the TechNet.
W2VL repeater.
Oh, yeah. Plenty of problems like that around. This is K2. Of course, you see in a basement a lot of times it clamps to the main, usually supposed to be intact, but a lot of them, they do renovations, and that the ground clamp to the main, to the neutral, is gone. As far as outside, Edison, been pretty careful of late years and make sure that they've seemed to be getting very leery after all these people have been getting electrocuted, stepping on those plates, especially we get a snowstorm and they salt the streets down and all, on sidewalks and everything. You've heard about a number of people that have been electrocuted, a number of animals. They were walking their dog and they stepped on one of those plates. So this is not a, you know, an unknown problem. And not only that, Rich, I guess if, you know, you're standing wet, I guess a good pair of boots can never hurt. Just slip on a good pair of rubber boots, and I'm sure that would go a long way for you to be protected. As far as lightning goes, the tower's been hit here a number of times, right on the coast here, and the highest thing around. Lightning just couldn't miss it. I have a rule that when they're not using the equipment, there is no antennas that are ever left connected here to the equipment. All the antennas are grounded away from the equipment. I've got a lot in the shack. And when I open the switches, when nothing is on in the shack, I leave. I open the switches. The switch is now the side of the switch that is going towards the equipment goes right to the ground, to my grounding system. So there's no way that the any part of the 110 volts, whether it be the neutral line or whatever, could still have a common line into the equipment. So you take as much precautions as you possibly can, but like I say, nothing is foolproof, Dick. Over.
Hey, Barry, into MB, if you're there. I wonder if you've heard some stories like this with some of the installations you've done in the Far Rockaway area. Let's see if Barry's still on frequency. Into MB, K2RAW in the TechNet. Because Barry got called away. Rich N2EO, have you ever heard Barry talk about stories like this with crazy things happening with the 110 wiring?
He's being struck by lightning. I sure have a few tales, yes.
Go right ahead and tell us your tales.
Okay, let me see here. My own house, I was in my house about 2 years ago, I think maybe 3 years ago now, that was so powerful. And I thought it came from the antenna, but it did not. It came through the power lines, and it actually burnt out a piece of BX cable in the ceiling of my living room. So I had to break the ceiling open. That's a long story how I located it. A little bit through trial and error. Essentially, I didn't have any electricity in the back of my house. All the ceiling lights wouldn't work in the back of my house as a result of that. I once had my tower struck by lightning so severely that the pipe that goes from the rotator through the thrust bearing, there's no thrust bearing there, it's actually a pipe, so there's two pipes that go inside the other, they fused together, and it had a rocket back and forth, and this was a motor that Dick now has. It's a prop pitch rotator motor, which is very strong, and that thing had trouble breaking that apart. It was incredible. I've had two customers that have had their CB antennas totally removed, nothing but shreds, and interestingly enough, the radio connected to the CB was fine. Didn't even blow the files or the front end. It was good. And the antenna was completely gone, not a piece left on the roof. I could probably think of more. K2RW and 2MV.
K2JJ, we're coming.
Fantastic, Barry. Wild. Lightning is very unpredictable stuff. Doug, I thought you guys got some kind of a contract up there in Yonkers where lightning doesn't strike there. K2JJ, K2IW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, we're up quite high here in places. Yonkers is also referred to as the city of hills where nothing's on the level, but that's another story. Interestingly enough, Dick, I had the main water valve in my house here replaced a few weeks ago. The first thing that plumber did when he came in here, he had a big, must have been a one-aught welding cable with screw-down clamps. The first thing he did was to put that cable on both sides of the pipe before he replaced that valve. So the word is getting out.
Glad to hear it. That gives him an awful lot of protection. That plus rubber gloves and whatever. Yeah, a simple water pipe looks very innocent, and you think you're protecting yourself from a flood and water running out and filling up the basement. something a lot more dangerous than that. That water running out of that pipe, falling onto a wet floor, and the 7,800 volt or the 13.2 kilovolt line, whatever your distribution power is in your neighborhood, that flowing through your house can do some terrible damage. I remember the neighbor across the street about 15 years ago, an automobile struck the telephone pole, and there was a 13 kilovolt line dancing on the ground, arcing and sparking, and the man's fuse panel in his basement completely burned up because he was the ground return for the Volpig transformer in that particular episode. So we'd like to believe that the primary winding of the step-down transformer outside of our house has two wires going to it. Unfortunately, it only has one, the high voltage wire. The other end of that has to be grounded by, if it's done correctly, the butt plate and a piece of 6-gauge or 4-gauge wire running down the utility pole. But an awful lot of them never get replaced. There's a ridiculous number of communities where some misguided individual comes along and steals that chunk of copper wire and sells it for scrap. It's sad, but that's the truth. There's a lot of communities where the local power company doesn't even bother replacing it because somebody will immediately come and steal it again. That's nickel and dime stuff by my standards, but there must be some very desperate people out there. Anyone else with any questions, comments, or whatever on all of the subjects we discussed tonight, give us your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2K, one more comment there.
SO2, okay.
Bell recognized. Who is the other person? Something okay?
LC1.
KO2 okay.
Okay, KO2 okay. KC2LTY and Mel. Mel first, go ahead.
Well, I've mentioned a number of times before. On top of my tower, on the pipe that goes up above the top beam, I have a pin. Called a desensitizing. It's a sharp pin. It's a steel pin that was driven into the cap. And in fact, I grazed it onto the cap to make good contact. And that taps the top of the pipe. And it sharpened like you would sharpen, you know, an ice pick. I feel that that desensitizes so that the lightning strike, when it hits, it reduces the amount of current because it comes to a very fine point, Dick, over.
Mel, I got to ask you a question about that.
Go ahead.
Do you ever get a howling sound in your radio sometimes before a thunderstorm?
W2VL repeater.
Yeah, I've heard corona noises. That's the funny part. I've heard outside sometimes some strange noises during the summertime. Sometimes hissing around. Around the tower area, you sometimes hear a funny kind of hissing at times, Barry, over.
Yeah, it's coming off of that point. I knew it. That's not uncommon. I've seen that done before, and it's accompanied, usually, you know, just before a thunderstorm comes in, you get a really strong, like a kind of a howling sound in all your radios. It's that. It's very interesting. I had a feeling you'd say that in 2MB.
Yeah, my 432 Yagi used to be the top thing on my 100-foot of tower. And there were times in the winter or summer when the corona discharge off of the elements of that top Yagi would give me a real loud howling sound out of my 432 radio. Nowadays, I make sure that I've got 5 or 10 feet of mast sticking out above the highest antenna, and I don't get that effect anymore. Okay, KC2LTY, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, to the point where the Mel's mentioned about the pinpoint rod, I saw a program on the Discovery Channel that about lightning, where you were in upstate New York, you have a barn with lightning rods on the roof. If you take a look at those, they all come to a very sharp point on the end. Apparently that attracts lightning better. And another thing is, a good friend of mine is a city electrician in New York. and he told me that if I'm transmitting with the radio, it will be attracting lightning more than if I wasn't. And the other thing is with the water mains, when you disconnect the main and the lights go out, that should not happen. Electrical service, it should be correct. The proper grounding from your meter panel, the water main, you should have the ground going to one side of the meter with a jumper to the other side, which means most likely you're not going to find. And there should be another ground wire from the meter pan down to a copper flat ground rod, which on old services you're not going to find. Getting disconnecting that main and the lights going out, so it's not normal. It's a bad neutral electrical service, which should be correct. What's your opinion on that?
Oh, no, I 100% agree with you. Any of these situations where you disconnect a water pipe, and if any of your lights in your house change brilliance or go out, it's a strong indication of improper wiring of the 110-volt circuit in your house. Or if you put a clamp on the ammeter across any of your water pipes and you see current flowing, it's a strong indication of something improper. It shouldn't be that way. And yes, I'd like to believe that all new wiring of houses have an independent grounding rod outside the house, so that they're not just depending on the 110-volt not just depending on the water pipe grounding. And because some houses have got PVC pipes running around, you don't have the option of using the water pipe as a ground. Bennett, KO2OK, what would you like to add? What's going on over there in Ridgewood, New Jersey? K2LIW, listening.
Hi, Dick. KO2OK, thank you very much. Just a comment. There was a fellow earlier. I forgot his call. He said he had a Mosley tri-bender he was going to put up shortly. Our Fairlawn, New Jersey radio club just put up a new Mosley. I think it's a TA-33 with the work add-on. And just a couple of notes. One is, it's very strange, but the boom-to-mass clamp is set up for an inch-and-a-half pipe, not a two-inch pipe, which is kind of annoying because I think most of our mass we use today is 2 inches for a good strong mass. Also, the instructions, the parts list is wrong. He'll find parts that are missing, but they actually aren't. When you add the work parts, they add in other parts, and they take away other parts. And sorry about that. Anyway, the instructions, the parts list won't match, but it goes together. And it's also very strange that the dual feed comes very close to the main mast, within 2 inches. And may want to wrap that just to avoid any interaction. That's it, Dick. Back to that. KO2OK.
Very fine, Bennett. Thank you for that information. And that was Andy, WA2CDL, who's the technical coordinator now for the Limark repeater, who's about to put up a Mosley TA-33 with the walk band Q-match, multi-band, a multi-array Q-match thing. So, yep, I can tell that antenna was designed some time ago when inch-and-a-half mast was popular. Nowadays, an awful lot of people are using a 2-inch and 2.5-inch mast. So modifying that mast to a boom clamp is going to require some effort. Anybody else want to bring up any subjects before we close down tonight? Let's see if we've got Paul. WS2N, are you around? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, real quick question. I disconnected the ground wire, the negative, from my power supply to the radio, and the radio flew away.
That doesn't surprise me, because by way of the coax cables going to your tower, the coax cables going between various pieces of equipment, there's a whole lot of ways that your negative lead. Most rigs that run on 12 volts, the chassis ground is the 12 volt return. And by way of the coax cables and whatever, there's a whole lot of ways the rig can be grounded. so that doesn't surprise me. However, the power supply itself, it probably has a metal chassis, and maybe the negative lead of the power supply is also grounded to the neutral of your 110-volt line. Quite a few power supplies are wired that way. So it's possible your circuit from your 12-volt power supply, the positive red lead is going to your rig and it runs it. The negative lead goes to the chassis of the power supply. The negative lead by way of the neutral third wire goes into the plug in the wall. Your some other piece of equipment that's connected with a coax cable to somewhere in your system has also got a similar ground. And so there's a lot of ways that our rigs can be grounded. And it would be interesting to trace that all out and find out how it's all coming about. Anybody with any further questions or comments? K2RW in the TechNet. K2RL.
Maybe we can discuss some a little further on antennas now that we've got the regular TechNet taking care of Dick. A couple of things I'd like to discuss with you. Unless Paul would like to join us, WS2N, this is K2KEY. You out there, Paul?
K2RL. Yeah, I think Paul's not there, but Steve has got a couple of words. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, I was going to ask you a question about the 2.4 gigahertz band, but I'm not sure if you have time tonight.
We'll squeeze you in. Go right ahead. There's a small fee involved. We're going to send you a bill.
Yeah, okay. I don't have a lot of money, though. I'm only an engineer. My question is, now at 2.4 gigahertz, we're allowed, I guess we overlap the 802.11 band by, I don't know, about 40 megahertz or maybe a little bit more. We cover one or two channels. My question is, they say that we can run spread spectrum up to 100 watts if you control the power and all that stuff, you know, automatic control. What are the legalities, for one thing, about running 802.11 B-card into like a high-gain antenna, maybe with a little bit of an amplifier, so it can connect to a friend about a mile away? And I have a 32-element Yagi, I guess you would call it, which is basically fed with a waveguide, circular waveguide into a Yagi. What do you think the chances are of connecting with somebody about a mile away using, let's say, 10 watts?
Yep. Very, very good. First of all, I think, and I'm not positive on this one, that if you follow all the FCC rules on 802.11 service, you're not allowed to run higher than 1 watt of power, and you're not allowed to run higher than something like 6 dB of antenna gain. So that's 4 watts of effective isotropic radiated power. I think those are the numbers. However, every so often on the websites and ham web list servers, you'll hear people running experiments from the mainland to Catalina Island. They're running all kinds of DX experiments. When you run a higher gain antenna, and you're usually aiming it with a narrow beamwidth at your specific buddy, and as such, the antenna directivity is not really hurting anybody else, except for some very rare circumstances. So I think there are some rules on this. I think there are a fair number of people who violate those rules, and I think it's a victimless crime. And until somebody complains about getting interference, I think there's no problem. But I'll bet you there are people on frequency who've got a lot more knowledge of 802.11 requirements than I do. On to one of those guys, speak up right now and tell us what the law is. K2RW in the TechNet.
K2J?
Go ahead, Eric.
Hi. First of all, if you run between channels 1 and 5, you can run as much power as you want as long as you identify with a CWID and turn the encryption off. But doing it legally, legitimately, and you'll find that most of the stuff is only 500 milliwatts. Don't forget, it's a direct sequence spread spectrum. You can put up a dish at one end and a dish at the other end. You'd be surprised how far you can go. I used to use one between our place, the station on 33rd Street, and to the World Trade Center. That's how I used to get data back and forth. Now they have one that's looking at the World at the Empire State Building. But you can make coffee can beef horn type antennas and do, you know, 5 and 10 mile hops without a problem. And as far as like interference goes, people don't notice it as an interference. What happens is all the links slow down a little bit. That's pretty much it. You know, it's CSS Spectrum show.